Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty along with my brother Brian. We are right at home here in the Morton Center at the Ag PhD Field Day site. Just wrapping up an Ag PhD 101 Ways to Cut Farm Expenses Today workshop. And we're taking questions from our audience here. And you know, Brian, there's so many questions today around, is this a good investment on my farm? Should I be cutting some of this out, trying to make more money this year? And you know, that is the big thing. We want to look at everything that's leaving our pockets for money. We want to look at where every one of those dollars goes and just analyze, hey, this might have been a smart move last year, but is it a smart move today? And I think that's important.
Yep, every year you got to reanalyze all the costs that you have on your farm and just determine what's important and what's not. All right, so again, if you've got a question for us.
We got one right over here,
yep,
Brian.
Just raise your hand and we'll come around to you with the mic.
I'm going to let you take it because this gentleman has the best red beard in the whole room, and he's even putting me to shame. And so that means he's intelligent, Brian, so it's going to be a tough question. All right, go ahead, Riley.
Riley from Canada. Question about.
I love how in around here we'd say, "Oh, from South Dakota," or "I'm from Sioux Falls," or whatever. No, I'm just Canada.
He's from the entire country of Canada.
I represent Canada. Anyway, go ahead.
My question is regarding banding versus broadcast.
Yep.
We use our wheat planting drill to band our fertilizer,
okay,
and we're planting our corn on 22-inch spacing. Should we be discounting our banding rate if we're that spread out?
Yeah, so when we talked about banding a little bit today, we said there are a couple big factors. Number one is tie-up, and number two is the fertilizer is now, for the most part, where the roots are going to run into it. So should you be discounting it a little bit? Probably, because you're in effect going to be probably 12 at, well, let's see. You're going to be at least 6 inches away one way or the other in some cases with some of that fertilizer. So that would most likely mean you're going to want to discount a little bit. The other thing, I'm just going to guess, since I know where you live, right, straight north of here, about probably 6 hours. There's
depends
a fair
on if Brian's driving, maybe only four
good
and a half.
Good point. Yeah, good point. But anyway, where I'm going with this is there's a fair amount of high pH soil there. And so as soon as we talk high pH soil, then I might discount it just a little bit more because even though we banded it, we'll have less tie-up. We're probably still going to have at least a little bit of tie-up in that high pH. Now, here's my other concern, and did you notice what he said? He's banding this with his seeder, okay? How deep is that fertilizer actually getting? It's not getting super deep, correct? So, yeah,
2 inches,
exactly. So when we're only 2 inches deep, what percent of the roots is below 2 inches, okay? So over the years, I've tried to study not just 6-inch soil tests, but let's see what's a little bit deeper in the ground. We'll show you this a little bit tomorrow, too, but even like the new state record holder here in South Dakota for soybean yield, at 18 to 24 inches deep, his soil's organic matter was, I don't remember the number off the top of my head, it's 5 to 6%, something like that. Just a crazy high level where you'd go, wow, that's great. In my 0 to 6, he had that in 18 to 24. And I can only assume that's part of the reason why he had the yield he did. A lot of high-yield growers in the past, they've got good levels as you go down a little bit in the soil. So I just worry that 2 inches is pretty shallow because where you're at in the world, you dry out from time to time. The top couple inches dries out. If you don't have moisture, then nutrients don't get in. And yeah, you might have roots down at 6 or 10 inches deep to bring water in, but if they're not able to bring nutrients in as well, it just, I'm not saying it's necessarily terrible, but I'm just saying it's a little bit concerning to me on a dry year. Yep. All right, let's go to our next question right over here.
I'm Doug from South Dakota. I was wondering, have you heard anything more on the soybean midge? Any way we can treat it or deal with it?
Yeah, speaking about the soybean gall midge larvae. So here's a little tiny fly that pierces into a soybean stem, and the soybeans are pretty small, lays its eggs inside the stem. Those eggs hatch, become little larvae, little worms that chew out the inside of the soybean stem. Now, most of the people in the room are sitting back, relaxed, thinking, well, don't have to worry about that one. That's one thing I don't have. Yeah, you might. I found one here at the field day site last year. I found one. I only found one on our farm. How many do you think we have on our farm? Do you think we only have one?
I'm sure you found the only one.
Well, it happened to be on some of Brian's ground, and I'm sure, yeah, we probably controlled the one that there was. No, there's going to be more, right? This is a problem that's really spreading across Nebraska, South Dakota, Minnesota, Iowa at this point, but it'll move farther than that, too, and we don't have a good answer. We don't have any way to kill those bugs once they're inside the stem. We don't have a BT trait. We don't have enough systemic activity with high enough rates of neonics on the seed treatment. So we're looking for other options. At this point, we just don't have any great ones.
No. So if you were to be out there every week spraying insecticide to kill all flies.
Every 2 days, probably, yeah. Spraying for the flies for a month, you'd probably do a pretty good job. But I know an operation they sprayed 4 times last year trying to get them, trying to kill the flies before they could infect those stems. They just couldn't keep up with it. They couldn't get it. They said they reduced the numbers a little bit, but they didn't take them out.
Also, we have to look at where do we have the big risk with this soybean gall midge. And by the way, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about here, there's a reason why. This is a brand new insect never before discovered in the world. There have been midges out there in different midge species, but never this exact species of soybean gall midge. And what it is, it's a little fly, lays eggs, the eggs hatch inside the soybean stem, and then they're eating out the inside of the soybean stem. The plant falls over later. We sometimes have big yield loss. And where we're seeing this predominantly is coming out of last year's beans, going into this year's beans. So if we're rotating corn and beans, it's right on that field border. That's where we're seeing the biggest damage. It's almost always on the field edges. And there have been reported cases of 50 bushel yield losses in those areas.
Oh, and more. Yeah, I've seen 80 bushel beans go to zero. So it's a big deal. And, yeah, the rotation is going to be one of your biggest tools that you can do. So if you've got a field that's half corn, half soybeans, you're just going to continuously see it there. So maybe it's something where you rotate away from beans or you block your beans in one area of the farm and have the corn farther away, something like that. I don't know how you do it, but at this point, we don't have a chemistry solution or a natural predator to take them out. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio today. We're broadcasting live from the Morton Center here at the Ag PhD Field Day site, following an Ag PhD 101 Ways to Cut Farm Expenses Today workshop. We'll be right back taking more questions from our audience. Stay tuned.
Every farmer knows that in order to be profitable, you need to maximize the return on your crop input investments. Hi, I'm Scott Harms, an agri-risk specialist with Grain PhD. Without an effective and flexible strategy, your grain marketing plan gets stuck in the mud. With Grain PhD, you get the clarity and guidance a solid marketing plan needs. Our free GrainBridge software simplifies your cost-profit analysis, and our risk specialists are here to help you develop your plan. Sign up today at grainphd.com.
Give your corn a strong defense against stress throughout the season with MycoApply EndoPrime SC. MycoApply EndoPrime SC uses 4 specially selected species of mycorrhizal fungi to protect your crop against stress. That means more access to water and key micronutrients while building a healthy soil structure for stronger crops for years to come. Stronger corn starts beneath the surface. Learn more about MycoApply EndoPrime SC at EndoPrimeCorn.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
When you build with Morton Buildings, you build something that lasts. And now you can build for less during Building Value Days. If you're dreaming of a personal storage building, horse barn, farm storage, home, office, insulated workshop, or even a commercial facility, take advantage of our discounted pricing on new buildings now through February 28, 2019. So don't delay. Visit MortonBuildings.com for more information.
Using N-Serve Nitrogen Stabilizer with fall fertilizer applications keeps nitrogen available into the spring for maximum crop growth. Field trials in Iowa show N-Serve delivered an average revenue increase of $22.96 per acre, and N-Serve is the only recognized nitrogen stabilizer product in the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy because it reduces nitrate leaching. That's max profit in an environmentally sustainable way. Calculate your field's profit potential at nitrogenmaximizers.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Morton Center right here on the Ag PhD Field Day site following an Ag PhD workshop today. We're taking questions from our audience, and it's interesting. We've got quite a diverse group from a lot of different states, and it's been fun just hearing what's on everybody's mind. Let's take a question back here.
Yeah, my name is Lars from Colton. I got two questions. One about when to turn your fans on in the bin and spraying the ditches. Well, one of the bins.
Yep.
My grandma just passed away, whatever, but she's pretty cheap and she doesn't buy the stuff to dry it down that much. So she just put fans in and wondering when to turn them on. Probably freeze them over the wintertime. And then also with the spraying the ditches, you guys said to do border spray. Do a lot on that. Would it help to spray in the ditches too or not?
Okay, let's talk about the bins first of all. I don't know that you necessarily want to freeze all the grain, but if we get it down under 40 degrees and we keep the humidity down, that's where we get really good storage conditions. And then as spring comes, we'll want to watch and monitor and keep the temperature of the grain within a certain distance of what the exterior is. So let's just say your grain's down to 35 degrees, and now all of a sudden we're 90 degrees outside in June. We want to start slowly warming up that grain a little bit, or we'll have some issues with that wild variance in temp. With the bin fan controls, there's several things. You're going to need proper ventilation on the bins. You're going to need enough power with those fans to circulate enough cubic feet per minute of air movement through the bins. So there's a few little things that you may need to upgrade on as well, because I get it. I know, for our dad, too, he farmed in times where they really had to watch their costs pretty close, so he wasn't wasting money, that's for sure.
Well, also, we didn't have the technology of having the automatic bin fan controls. I'll give you the example of we had a year where, this is probably 15 years ago, where in the fall we just couldn't get a day where the soybean moisture was good. It was 15-16%. We're like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? Let's just try harvesting. Threw them in some bins. We used to have bins right out here, and I manually would turn the fans on and off. Because there are charts out there, and you can just look at this online and just see what the grain moisture charts are for soybeans or corn or anything else, and it will tell you, okay, if the temperature is X and the humidity is at a certain level, then it will tell you what the grain moisture will be. And so by knowing that, if you have the fans on at the right time, you can either lower moisture down or you can raise moisture back up. It's all perfectly legal. There's nothing wrong with it. All you're doing is pumping air in, but because of the humidity and temperature, it will change the moisture of the grain. Problem is, I stunk at that. Okay? So either I didn't get there on time, I wasn't paying close enough
attention. You may have seen this today. Brian can get easily distracted.
Or I was just bad at it. I don't know. But anyway, the point is with the automatic controls, like this fall, we literally took beans from 17% down to 13% in 3 weeks with the automatic controls. It was amazing. Never had to touch a thing, just turned it on. 3 weeks later, we come back, beans are all 13%. It's perfect. But when we talk about just storage in general, yeah, Darren's right. I mean, we just want to make sure we're trying to keep the grain cool. But we have to worry about condensation. There are many things we could talk to you about there. When you say spraying ditches, we do spray all our ditches for weeds, okay? And most people do spray their ditches for weeds.
Yeah, and here's a good spot where Freelex would be the best choice. So rather than the old 240 amine or 240 ester, the new Freelex, it has the 240 choline in it, doesn't have the volatility concerns. Now, you still have the concerns with wind. If it blows out into the field, that could be a problem. But this is a really nice product, and I think for township boards and just you spraying around your own fields and around your neighbor's fields, that's a great switch.
In addition to that, we very commonly have thrown insecticide in when we're worried about grasshoppers or certain other insects. We find them in the ditch and we go, ooh, we better kill them now before they become a problem out in our field.
Now,
I don't mind losing a little grass, but I do mind losing some crop.
Okay, I would say this, though. You want to invest in a sweep net, and just run the sweep net through those ditches first before you throw insecticide in. If you don't have any harmful bugs, there's no way on earth I'm throwing in an insecticide, because what are you going to kill? Pollinators,
beneficials, yep.
Those kinds of things. So I want to make sure that I've got a problem out there first before I do it.
And here's the other thing. See, you talked about your grandma and stuff. I'll just ask you this. How many people in the room are going out in their ditches with a sweep net? You don't even have to raise your hand, because I know nobody's doing it. Now, just because nobody's doing it does not mean that's the right or wrong thing to do. But what we're saying is you take one extra step, just take a few minutes, do a little sweeping in the ditch, find out if we got harmful bugs there. If you're going spraying anyway, it only costs a couple bucks to throw insecticide in. And if we need it, you may have just saved yourself thousands of dollars across fields by killing the bugs before they get out into the field.
All right, good questions. Let's take another one over here.
Hi, I'm Matt from South Dakota. You spoke a lot about fertility today,
yep.
And specifically on the potassium and the zinc. I was looking at my fertility, and you were talking about zinc levels in the fives today, and on my...
That's for Brian's excessive phosphorus levels of 50 okay. parts per
I don't
night.
Know that I call it excessive, but I'm going for high yield, yes.
Right.
Okay.
See, Brian had an addiction.
Continue on.
He had an addiction for nitrogen. Now I think he's kind of transitioning. That was maybe a gateway into phosphorus addiction. So now we're working on this crazy phosphorus level that now once he has that, then that transitions into a zinc addiction.
The zinc
and now he's like, well, this 3 parts per million is not enough. I need at least 5.
And I overdid that too. But anyway, so go ahead.
And that, I guess that's part of my question is,
yes.
You know, I have potassium and zinc levels in the high marks, say on my charts.
Sure.
How much is enough and how much is not enough on potassium? Never added it before and... You know, I have pH levels in the 7 to 7.7 typically.
Okay. It makes a lot of difference what lab is testing it and what extraction method we're talking about. So I just pulled up on the screen here, know how to read a soil test. And we've got steps 1 through 12 right there. And you can see, like we say on there, point number 8 is zinc. 1.8 to 3.5 is pretty common and fine, you know, for a lot of halfway decent soils. But on top of that, you got to take a look at this phosphorus to zinc ratio. Because what does happen sometimes is we deal with a lot of people who spread a lot of manure, for example. And that might be high in phosphorus, low in zinc. Well, if we start getting 200 parts per million of phosphorus out there and we're down at that kind of level at 1.8 parts per million on zinc, we go, oh, that's probably going to create an issue in the plant, and it often does. So that's one of the things. But yeah, in terms of that test there on the zinc, that's with a DTPA test. So if it was a Malic 3 test and a different lab than Midwest Labs, then we might tell you something different. So you've got to kind of talk to your lab and find out, all right, what do you recommend? What should I have based on your extraction methods and your results over time? So don't get too terribly alarmed by what you're seeing here because it might be different for your lab and your situation. In terms of potassium, though, you'll notice in point number 4 there on base saturation, we do like to see that base saturation K in the 4 to 8% range.
And this is where it gets a little tricky because you look at parts per million a lot of times, and maybe you've got 200 parts per million, and it says, oh, you're very high in potassium. But if all your other nutrient levels are way high, and now you see, well, that's only a 1% base saturation because I've got heavy soils, That is kind of the gauge of, well, what's the ratio that's out in your field, and we'd like to see that ratio on potassium a little bit higher. So we'd like to look at both those measurements. Parts per million is important, but we'd also like to see how it is in ratio with other nutrients by looking at base saturation.
And then in your books, we did have where if you look at this, in terms of 300 bushel corn, 100 bushel beans, how much total potassium do they take? Look at that 300 bushel corn. It takes 405 pounds of K2O potassium. It is not a small amount. Now, granted, most of that's to produce the stover, and it's going to stay in the field when you leave the stover there. 330 of that will stay there. But still, you got to have the 405 to begin with. So we're looking at the base saturation level just as a general soil balance fertility thing. But if you had light soil and low parts per million, you got to get those parts per million up for that crop because otherwise there's no way to raise 300 bushel corn. Right?
Right, yeah. Potassium is one of those nutrients that I think we really need to look at tests and see both those measurements to have an idea. And then, you know, when you talked about the zinc as well, Brian was talking about higher rates of zinc because of the ratio that we'd like to see that with phosphorus. When we get high phosphorus levels, we need to see a high level of zinc as well. Otherwise, we have some issues.
Tomorrow at our Secrets to High Yield Fields workshop, we've got some really interesting data on thousands of data points showing you yield for zinc and also phosphorus to zinc ratio. So it's going to be interesting tomorrow.
Stay with us. We'll be right back after this.
No secrets here. We all know, regardless of the markets, balanced crop nutrition pays. Agro-liquid fertilizers have the research, technology, and products you need to grow a great crop. We also have an outstanding team of field agronomists ready to help you determine the best use of your fertilizer dollar. Agro-liquid can help you maximize your yield potential effectively and economically. Visit agroliquid.com to find a dealer near you.
Your independent spirit is more rewarding than ever before. Unlike incentive programs that require growers to purchase a particular seed brand or to bundle certain products, the FMC Freedom Pass program rewards you for making the best choices for your fields. You decide what's best for your operation, from pre-plant to harvest. Your retailer and FMC take care of the rest. It's really that simple. The exclusive agronomic rewards, performance assurances, application innovations, and product financing of the FMC Freedom Pass program make it easier to protect your crops and cash flow. That's what we mean when we say we give you more freedom in the field. You'll experience more control and confidence, too. Generics and imitators can't promise that. Visit your authorized FMC retailer or FMCFreedomPass.com to calculate your potential financial incentive and learn more.
High-yield corn growers know that feeding the crop and soil are keys to maximizing yield potential. Nutec's EDA and Reverb are specifically formulated to help manage limiting factors associated with today's farming conditions. Nutec's EDA works within the plant to support nutrient mobility and utilization. Reverb focuses on the soil, providing beneficial trace elements which help condition the root zone for optimal microbial activity. Low use rates and superb tank mix compatibility make Nutec's EDA and Reverb no-brainers in the high-yield grower toolbox.
What do you think of when you hear Palmer amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean field, you don't have to think about them at all. With two effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer amaranth. Take control of your soybean field and get rewarded with Roundup Ready Plus when you choose the proven power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? The Soil Warrior can reduce trips across the field, optimize nutrient placement, and improve soil health. So you can lower production costs without losing yield. See what makes the Soil Warrior different and better at SoilWarrior.com.
The Guardian Air Twin Spray Nozzle from HyPro produces a twin spray pattern with air-inducted droplets for superior coverage, even in dense canopies. Be effective and efficient with your spray application this season with the Guardian Air Twin. HyPro, helping you spray better.
You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Really appreciate it. We've got a live audience here at the Morton Center at the Ag PhD Field Day site. We just wrapped up an Ag PhD workshop today. And if you say, man, I wanted to get to one of those workshops, I haven't made it to one, are there still any more coming up? There are, but we're starting to run out. If you go to agphd.com and click on the events tab, you can pre-register for any of our upcoming workshops. We've got one tomorrow right here at the Ag PhD Field Day site again. We're going to be talking about secrets of high-yield fields, and that one's pretty exciting. What are the yield-limiting factors? What are the things that you should really focus on building in your soils to get higher yields and more profits on your farm?
Yep, we've got soil tests from some of the highest-yielding farmers in the country. It's super exciting. It's just interesting seeing what some of the similarities and some of the differences are. But, I'm really excited about tomorrow.
That'll be fun.
Yep, we've got a workshop. It's 9 a.m. all the way till 2 p.m., and then we've got our radio show right after.
And we've got a workshop a week from today down in Brinkley, Arkansas. We're at Commodity Classic coming up at the end of the month, a couple of days. We've also got a real cool one coming up in March 5th through the 7th. Neil Kinsey is coming to our farm, and he's going to be doing a three-day workshop on soil fertility. You can sign up for that on our website as well. All right, let's get back. We've got a gentleman that's been waiting ever so patiently with a fantastic South Dakota State Jackrabbits hat. Let's take that question next.
Gary from South Dakota, you talked about starter fertilizer and not putting more than 3 gallons of 1034 in furrow.
Correct.
Yep. We've got splitters. How far can we push that?
Well,
you know, this is always the question for farmers too. It's always, well, how much can I push it? What else do I need to do? And but it's a fair and legit question.
It's a big deal though, Brian. You get some soil in between that seed and the fertilizer. Yep. Now you've got a cushion there.
Because we talked about cutting the rate and adding water and that kind of thing. Well, that's not that we can or want to cut our total rate of fertilizer, but we're just very concerned about crop injury because both Darren and me have been out on fields where guys have hurt themselves by putting too much 1034-0 out there, and the response they usually will give us is, well, I've done it for 10 years and never had a problem. I understand that, but what we're worried about for anybody that's listening is we don't want you to spend money, and even if it's 1 out of 10 years, have that hurt you and have that cost you, in some cases, 50 bushels of corn. We just can't have that.
Yeah, so, now a lot of it comes down to what kind of soil you've got. So if you've got, let's just say you have really light, sandy, low organic matter soil, and you're going to move over a couple of inches, can you up the rate? You bet you can up the rate, but it's kind of limited how far you push it. Let's say you've got really heavy dirt, lots of clay, lots of organic matter, and you're a couple inches to the side, you can push it even further. If you're in a high moisture environment, you can push it even further. I mean, so you have to just factor those things in. If you say I'm dry and I've got light soils, I don't know how far you want to push that. I know South Dakota State's done a number of studies with nitrogen, looking at how close they can get to the seed and how much they can put out, because a lot of guys are doing a strip till where they're down maybe 6 inches or where they're off to the side a couple inches, maybe even on both sides of the row. You can push it a ways, but not, you can't really get crazy.
All right. I'll just say this. With your splitters, you're not doing anything. It's not like you're moving it 2 inches over or anything else. It's still right there. Yes, you're going to hit dirt instead of the seed, hopefully. I'm still not going to take any more chances than 3 gallons. Honestly, that's what I'm going to do. That's my limit on 1034-0. Now, if you want more fertilizer in furrow, I'd switch to a low-salt product. That's what we do anyway, just to keep it safe. Because there's an article, I think, that's going to be in the next Ag PhD magazine about just phosphorus, because let's face it, 1034-0, you got nitrogen and phosphorus, that's it. How about if you put other things in there? Would potassium help? Would a little bit of micronutrients help? We're finding that both of those things can help. Well, if I add that, well, that's more salt again. So I'm just trying to say, if it's me and I'm going 1034-0, yeah, that's the max even with splitters, 3 gallons. But instead, what I would probably do is switch to a low salt product and consider more of a blended nutrient program as opposed to just N and phosphorus. But it depends a little bit on your soil test. If I looked at your soil test and I saw, oh, you got 8% base saturation K and every micronutrient's through the roof and my phosphorus is low, well, then obviously that makes sense why you just want the phosphorus out there. But I'd look at the soil test before I'm doing anything else. Good question.
All right, let's take another one back here.
Hi, I'm Todd from Nebraska. We picked up a new farm that we know that the first thing that we were going to have to fix was the soil pH. We did grids on the farm. Unfortunately, the pH is in the 5.2 down to a 4.8 range. We've started liming it now. My question to you guys is how hard, how fast can we attack the pH with lime? Current plan, I mean, we did one pass of liming now. We know it's going to take another one again. Do you do that in year two? Do you do it in year three? Our current plan is year three or year four, come back, hit it again. And how important would it be to do some tillage to get it down into
the
ground
lower?
Did you
say this was irrigated ground or dry land?
No, dry land.
Okay. Yeah, rainfall is going to help us. The other thing is going to be how much of that lime is going to be active in year one, so the calcium carbonate equivalent. Brian's pulling up a lime quality slide, I'm sure, but
I'm gonna
one
pull
of the
up
mistakes,
a lime fineness thing.
Yeah, one of the mistakes that we made on our farm is jumping the gun too quick with that next lime application, and we end up overdoing it. So, depending on what you're putting out there, you may want to wait for 3 years just to see how much of that's gonna release, and then I would do some soil sampling. You don't have to do it on a grid or anything, but at least a few spots just to see, all right, how am I moving the pH? How's it going? And then seeing if it's starting to tail off.
Yeah, I was much more gung-ho on all the liming stuff till we screwed it up on our own farm.
See, normally you see with Brian, it's the gas pedal down to the floor all the time. And sometimes that's good, and sometimes it's not. And, yeah, you just gotta know when to slow up just a little bit sometimes.
So, anyway, what I've got up on the screen here, it's lime fineness, and this is a chart from 2005. and a researcher that put this out. But basically, it's just showing the finer grade of lime that you've got, the faster it's going to change the pH, and the more effectively and more permanent it's going to change that pH. But yeah, you can see they basically reached their peak in less than 12 months. Now, I don't remember where this study is from, but all I know is it wasn't in our environment that's cold and dry. So the colder you are and the drier you are, the longer that breakdown is going to take. And so I'm going to enter that into my thinking a lot more in the future than I did in the past. I just pretty much looked at a lot of these charts and said, oh, we should be good. We've got 100 mesh lime. We should be fine in a year or 2 years. For us, it's taking about 3 years, even with the super fine lime.
What about and look at some of those tillage, other ones? Brian, comment on the tillage too.
Yep, I'll comment on the tillage, but also take a look at the 8 to 20, or even the 20 to 30. I mean, it takes a really long time for that to go. If you're tilling, then stuff's going to happen a little faster in many cases. If you're not tilling, you can change that pH going down, but it's going to take time for that to move down and move with rain and everything. So all I'm saying is I'm on board with you adjusting that pH. We had similar pHs on some of our ground. Liming at first, fantastic. And we're like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. We got to continue this, but just don't get too carried away. Because all I can tell you is you start getting that pH up to 7 and above for corn, soybeans, wheat, those crops, that is not a good thing. And now you've spent more money. All right, let's see, where's our next question at? Yep, we're right here. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, guys. Charles from North Carolina. With regards to the goal of 10 bushels per
1,000
on corn.
Yep.
How realistic do you think that is under normal conditions, and what would your three top means be for the average producer to get there?
First of all, I loved how you said normal conditions. I don't know.
I don't know if anybody in North Carolina had normal conditions in the last 12 months.
We do know a farmer this year in North Carolina that raised 350 bushel corn on 24,000 plants per acre. That's the highest that we have found ever anywhere that anybody's told us. And what are the most important factors to get that out? I just say it's all the stuff that we talk about. It's I got to have good drainage. In North Carolina, you may want to address the irrigation side. But then you got to look at balanced
soil.
Or the
hurricane side.
Well, but everything. I mean, balanced soil fertility. So you go through all the soil fertility stuff, controlling the weeds, the insects, diseases. There aren't just three things. We'd really kind of need to take a look at the whole program. I mean, it can be done pretty quickly. But we got to do everything we can to raise a great crop.
We're broadcasting live from the Ag PhD Field Day site at the Morton Center, taking questions from our audience. We'll be right back after this.
Hey, Bill, any advice to control tough weeds and rootworms?
That's easy, Jim. Buy two, save three.
Wait, for weeds and rootworms?
Buy two, save three. Combine your Impact or new Impact Z herbicide purchase with a qualifying insecticide and save $3 per acre.
Buy two, save three. That is good advice.
For details, go to buy2save3.com. Impact, Impact Z, and Buy Two Save Three are trademarks owned by AMVAC Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
Your grain bin fans can cost you a lot. High electric bills from running when conditions are not ideal, shrinkage from overdried grain, and spoiled grain all take money out of your pocket. With the Steps GMS app temperature humidity switch, get your bin fans to start making you money. Only run vans when the conditions are right. Eliminate shrink and spoilage in your bins. Deliver grain in top condition at market moisture. When every dollar counts, you need Steps GMS. Contact us today at stepsgms.com.
In farming, getting things done early has a way of setting you up for success. Like using Corvus for an early season win over weeds. Corvus keeps even the toughest weeds from gaining a foothold. Multiple sites of action deliver superior control of emerged weeds. And later, Corvus reactivates with just a half inch of rain to take out any new weeds that may have sprouted. So get an early season win against weeds with Corvus for end of season rewards. Always read and follow label instructions. Corvus is a restricted use pesticide.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds.
Vellum is Rotem North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Vellum. For more information, visit vellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
1 year it could be moisture stress, another Pythium or nematodes. So you need your soybeans to rise ready for whatever the season holds. Now one simple decision provides coverage on four fronts. The Acceleron portfolio, fungicides, insecticides, bioenhancers, and an industry-leading nematicide that strikes where nematodes attack. This season, rise stronger with Acceleron seed treatment products. Learn more at AcceleronSAS.com/riseready. Performance may vary. It's important to use proper PPE when handling treated seed.
Are you frustrated with white mold showing up year after year in your soybeans? If you have tried fungicide applications and are still losing yield to white mold, now is the time to ask your seed dealer about Heads Up Plant Protectant. Heads Up is the first EPA-registered seed treatment for the prevention of white mold in soybeans and pulse crops. The first line of defense on your farm against white mold now starts with the right seed treatment package. Locate a Heads Up dealer near you by visiting headsupst.com today.
Thanks for listening to Ag PhD Radio today. I'm Darren Hefty, along with my brother Brian. We're broadcasting live from the Morton Center at the Ag PhD Field Day site following an Ag PhD workshop today. We're taking questions from our audience, and questions have really been all over, Brian.
Yeah, just one thing. We were talking about this during the break, but just to catch up our listening audience, we had the question right before the break about what do we need to do to get to, say, 10 bushels per thousand on corn. But please don't misunderstand. We're not saying, oh, everybody should cut their rate on corn population or anything. What we're simply saying is we're, as agronomists and farmers, always trying to figure out what our yield limiting factors are. And if your yield is less than 7 bushels per thousand, so for example, if you're planting 30,000 population and only getting 150 bushel corn, well, that's not real good. That's 5 bushels per thousand. There's something else most likely that's limiting your yield, not planting population. Now, if you're up to 10 bushels per thousand, the odds are pretty high. Yeah, that, you might need to increase your planting population. I'd be looking at that hard. And we can all sit there and say, well, my average isn't this or my average isn't that. But I want you also thinking about how about your highest yielding spots and how about your lowest yielding spots? This is why we talk so much about varying planting populations, because we got some areas, like even on our farm, that are yielding 300. Okay, I'd probably need to treat that different than the areas on our farm that are yielding 150. All right, let's get to the next question here.
Yes, there's Doug from Minnesota. On the corn, I've been trying to talk my son into 28,000.
28,000 planting population?
You think he's planting too much?
He's at 32, and he doesn't want to come down.
Well, hey, let me ask
from Dad. Yeah. Not working.
Yeah, but hang on. Have you guys run any trials with that? Have you done any experiments? 28 versus 32.
No. Way.
Okay.
Not yet.
Okay. So this happens.
What my question really was: the 120,000 plants in 30-inch soybeans in in 30-inch rows. Can we go lower than that?
You know, this is a good question. We're talking corn and soybeans here, but the same applies to other crops too. Guys are always looking at, well, hey, there's some benefits here for cutting back. Like Brian talked about white mold issues, and guys that have cut back on populations have said, well, we had less white mold. Didn't go away, but we had less white mold where we didn't have quite as thick a stand out there. But then there's some other guys that say, man, I'm sure glad I planted more plants because I had some light hail and it wiped out some of the plants, and now I got enough plants that I still have a good stand and don't have to replant.
Okay.
So there's always trade-offs here on all these things. Same on corn. It's kind of nice to have a certain amount of stand out there. You get the canopy quicker. You catch more sunlight potentially. A little thinner stand. You know, it can still work, and it could still maximize yield, but there's some trade-offs.
I know where you guys farm, and it's not – I mean, it's a little ways from here, but you're kind of in line with us. And I'll just tell you, on our farm, like even on this field right back here, we've done a lot of planting population studies, and 32 to 36,000 for us is what has maximized profit. That's not to say that 28 might not work, but you two can settle your debate just like Darren and I usually do. Let's prove it in the field on a small scale. So generally what we do is we continue doing what we've been doing if we think, that's a pretty good way to go, but let's try a little bit of this and do maybe a little bit of strip trial work and just see. In terms of the soybean thing, there has been a lot of talk about guys cutting back planting populations on soybeans. I really worry about it. We have done a lot of planting population work in the past, and usually higher populations win in terms of yield. But you have to look at, okay, how about profitability? I think back even years ago, our dad did a lot of those trials, and 300,000 was where he had the best yield. Well, we can't afford to plant 300,000. He wasn't gaining enough yield to afford to plant 300,000. Okay, but you've got to weigh those factors in. What we're most concerned about with soybeans is you've got to look at germ and the cold germ. And the germination will be put right on the tag. The cold germ will not. So it's very common for germination score to be 90% and for a cold germ to be 80%. Okay, so if you're planting in anywhere cold, well, I know where you farm. In Minnesota, it's cold in the spring, let's face it, most of the time. So if, let's say, your seed germination was only 80%, if you're planting 120,000, what's that leave you with? You see where I'm going on this. Now, all of a sudden, you're under 100,000 what you have left out there. So you got to weigh those things in. If I'm going to cut my planting population, I want to ask the seed company, what's the cold germ on this? And don't just tell me what the tag is on the germ. What's the actual test on this lot? How is it? Or get the seed a couple weeks before you plant and send it in yourself and find out how is the germ and go from there. But yeah, I get concerned. Here again, just start running some trials on your own farm. But where you're probably going to have the most problem, like we said earlier today, is let's say you have any crusting, any hail, where you have a weedier field, all these factors. That's where the low planting population could actually hurt you. But yeah, there's a lot of talk about that, a lot of questions. Just look real hard at the germ and the cold germ.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to do those studies, though, on your farm. Just adjust that population in a couple of strips and just see. Maybe you say, okay, 32's worked for us. Let's do that, but we'll put some strips of 28 out there. And I'd also put some strips of 34 in or something like that and just see, you know what, maybe we're too light. Maybe we're too heavy. Who knows?
One thing, too, that I know this is something Randy Doughty has talked about for a while at even some of our meetings. In every field he's got, at least this is what he's said or what I've heard him say, he's planting three different varieties at three different populations. Okay, just to spread the risk, because the thing is, we don't know, like this last year, did anybody know that was going to be the wettest year in the history of the state of Minnesota? Nope, had no idea. How about this next year? It could be the wettest, it could be the driest, we have no idea. So all of a sudden, last year, a higher planting population probably worked out great. Fungicide worked out great. There are a lot of these things that worked out great last year. Well, we don't know about this next year. So spreading the risk at least a little bit does make some sense too. All right, we got time for another question here before our
all
break.
Right, right in the back here.
Yep. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm Willis from Iowa. Another question on potassium. I get manure ground, so I've got pretty high levels of potassium, maybe roughly in that 340 parts per million.
Okay.
But in order to get up to my 4% base saturation, I probably have to go up to 400, which is 60.
Yep.
Is that a wise use of money, just to dump on an extra 60 parts per million of potassium?
It most likely is. Here's the other thing. Let me just ask you one quick follow-up question. Do you own the ground or are you renting it?
I rent it from family, some of it from family. So,
long-term.
Long-term.
Yep. Hopefully long-term, yes. if it's long-term ground, then I don't get that worried about it, and here's exactly why. Because most of the time, and especially with the parts per million you told me, I know right away you have relatively heavy soil, right? Okay, so relatively heavy soil. What are the odds that you're going to lose that potassium if there's too much out there? Slim to none. Okay, it's not going anywhere. When it's not going anywhere, what's my risk? If I put some extra out and I say, I don't know that that really paid, just cut back for the next couple of years and there you go. Now you're back just fine and you didn't spend any extra total dollars. So that's the one way that I would look at it if I own the ground or rent it, but it's long-term ground. We have found that potassium, having good potassium levels, really helps not just with yield, but with grain quality, with test weight, with standability. So there are a lot of different factors there that we find are very, very important. And I know the parts per million sounds good, but if you start running tissue analysis, you'll very commonly find that the potassium levels, until you get up above that 4% base saturation K, the potassium levels might be just a little bit subpar in your tissue.
Yeah, especially late season. Usually early season, we're going to see that kind of thing be really good, and then you're going to see a big tail off, which we've seen on our own farm too.
And the reason why is because you get so much calcium and probably a lot of magnesium there, and magnesium especially interacts negatively with potassium. So the magnesium gets into the plant and it's causing the potassium not to get into the plant. So we got to work on that balance all the time of the potassium and the magnesium thing. So, yep, I still would. I'd still put a little more out there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Whenever you talk about manure, it's a great source of fertility, but it's generally not a complete source of fertility where it has everything exactly what you want in the perfect balance. A lot of times I'll talk to guys that have chicken litter or dairy manure or hog manure that'll say, man, I'm doing great on these nutrients, but the hole in my
Yeah, but let me throw this process out to you, Darren. Maybe if we work on getting the balance in the soil right in the first place, then the food that we feed the livestock is more balanced, and then the manure that comes back is more balanced
as
well.
It's going to help. That's right, because it's a vicious cycle. If you're feeding something short in a nutrient and you're not dealing with it properly in the ration, what's coming back out in your field is going to be short as well. Taking questions from our audience here, following an Ag PhD workshop. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Want to turn smart agronomics into smart economics? Go with the all-new Grow Smart Rewards program. 1. Start with a smart agronomic plan. 2. Qualify with the purchase of a participating BASF herbicide. 3. Earn $1+ per acre for each qualifying pair-up brand. Plus, you may qualify for an additional $75 per gallon back on our industry-leading fungicides. For full program details, go to GrowSmartRewards.com. Grow smart with BASF.
Clean fields and higher yields start with a strong battle plan. For soybean growers, there's no stronger ally than Sonic herbicide. When applied pre-emerge, Sonic has proven to defeat yield robbers like water hemp, mare's tail, and giant ragweed. With long-lasting residual control, it keeps fighting to defend your field from invaders. Visit battleweeds.com to plan your attack against weeds. Always read and follow label directions.
Sir, yes, sir!
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at SoilWarrior.com.
In farming, there's a lot of variables out of our control. Don't let fertility be one of them. Let the experts at AgroLiquid move you closer to your bullseye. It's true. AgroLiquid fertilizers are formulated to keep nutrients available to your crop, and they have unmatched compatibility with other nutrients and crop protection products, which makes application more efficient than ever. But we also have the best people in the field, ready to talk about your operation, your goals. Go to AgroLiquid.com to move you closer to your target.
In order to be the best farmer you can be, you've got to have a grain marketing plan. But what do you do when you're too busy out in the fields trying to maximize yield? Hi, I'm Darren Hefty. My brother Brian and I are always busy learning more about how to make our farm more successful. That's why we use Grain PhD to learn more about grain marketing and to work with our Grain PhD risk expert to create a complete grain marketing strategy. Visit grainphd.com to learn more about a free consultation for your operation.
When you build with Morton Buildings, you build something that lasts. And now you can build for less during Building Value Days. If you're dreaming of a personal storage building, horse barn, farm storage, home, office, insulated workshop, or even a commercial facility, take advantage of our discounted pricing on new buildings now through February 28, 2019. So don't delay. Visit MortonBuildings.com for more information.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty along with my brother Brian. We're broadcasting live following an Ag PhD workshop. And if you'd like to catch Brian and me at a speaking event coming up, just go to agphd.com, click on the events tab. You can see where we're at, and you can pre-register as well. Let's take our next question here.
Hey, guys. I'm Brian from Southwest Iowa. We've been talking about ways to save money, and one of those that you mentioned was writing your own prescriptions.
Yep.
That's something that we've been doing, I've been doing on our family farm for quite some time, but I always feel like I'm an amateur at it. You know, I'm using pretty basic software, and we are using composite mapping for multiple years for yield to try to get a better picture.
Yep.
But I feel like it's such a critical element that sometimes I wonder if I'm really making good choices. You know, you have to determine how many zones do you have? When do you change the gradients from one to another? You know, and other software allows you to use satellite imagery or many other options. Sometimes I just wonder, am I really saving money, or am I just doing a poor job of writing my own prescriptions? And it's something that really should be, you know, better left to a professional that is using more powerful software that has a lot more experience.
Okay. There are some of them out there, but not many. So I would say this, you're doing at least as good as anybody else is, but what you're really longing for, I think, is a little more data, too.
Yeah, so the software isn't the killer, and the more experience, I don't really care that much about
it. You don't
experience.
Have to have all this Brian's gray hair to do a good job at it.
But the data, to Darren's point, the data is the key. If you don't, you're only as good as your data. It's just like I just pulled this up again. We talked about this earlier today. If I got a 10-acre grid or if I got a 2.5-acre grid, all of a sudden with that 10-acre grid, I'm spreading fertilizer wrong. Now, did I do anything wrong with the data that I was given? No, I didn't. So to your point, if I'm using composite tests, I just took the data, I'm doing the best I can with it, and we go from there. But you don't have enough data if you're composite. And just like this, so my point earlier today that I had made is if I say I've got really variable ground, okay, let's say the whole field, you did these 10-acre grids, and every single spot was 5.7, you start feeling pretty good, like, yep, the whole field needs lime. But in this case, I had as low as 5.6 and as high as 8.3. When I see that and I see there's variability out there in my ground, that's where I want to make that grid size smaller.
Yeah, because you take those first points. If you would have had just one sample for that field, you average those first six ones together, they average 6.6. You would have said, huh, right in the middle of the sixes. Perfect.
Now, I know this is going to be a big ask, but what I tell people is, and we mentioned this earlier, smaller first, bigger later.
Well,
in other words, I go down to 1-acre grids on one field, take one field, and let's see what we find in that. And then once I start to even things up with my prescription mapping, over time I can start combining grids, go to bigger grids, that kind of thing. But at least once, I'd like to know on a really small scale, how are we doing in each of these areas on the farm? Because with that data, it's tremendously powerful.
It really comes down to what kind of a grid can you manage. And some guys with big equipment tell me, man, I can't really go any smaller than 2.5 acres. I can't. Stuff isn't going to switch for me fast enough, or my booms are so darn big that I'm over an acre in like that long. And so they'll run with 2.5. Whatever it is, try and get smaller. So if small is 2.5 and it seems, oh my gosh, 2.5 is unmanageable for me hardly, maybe that's the place you start and then build from there. But yeah, getting more data is going to help you. Doing complete analysis is another thing. We see a number of guys that aren't doing micros and they say, well, I'm getting the NP and K and then I'll just throw a blended micro out there to try and cover that up. I would say do some testing, because who knows, maybe one of those micros you're crazy high in for some reason, and we'd want to totally avoid that one. By putting any more out, we're hurting ourselves.
As soon as you mentioned, I'm kind of an amateur, it just reminded me of when we first started doing our own tiling. So our farm manager, Mike Luters, he was around here earlier, maybe still is here. But anyway, hey, Rob Fritz or Lee Fisher, make sure our farm guys are here for the dicamba training, right? Mike and Todd, yes. Okay, good. Anyway. here's my point.
I see Mike now.
Yep. So Mike and I, the first couple years we had our own tile plow, Mike was all worried that we weren't doing it right. And, you know, he's trying to be conscientious.
Well, because who's going to have to fix it, Brian? Let's right. be honest. Who's going to fix right. it if it's not right?
Right. We're going to blame
not
him.
Brian.
But, no, I just said, Mike, here's the deal. You let me do all the worrying. You just drive the tractor. Okay? It's fine. But we're going round and round for a couple years about this. So I said, okay, let's just go over to University of Minnesota. They've got a tile clinic. It's a two-day deal. And so we'll learn all about this stuff. So we go through the whole morning. Mike and I are there and everything, learning all this stuff. In the afternoon that first day, the instructor gives us all a topography map. And he says, okay, I want all of you guys to lay out the tile design you would have if this was your farm. So we just, you know, get started with that. And he goes, oh, wait, I should tell you this. If I took this same map and I handed it to six really great tiling contractors, super experienced, everything else, I'd probably get six different maps back, and they'd probably all work just fine. And so right then, Mike and I just kind of turned to look at each other and kind of laugh like, okay, this isn't exactly rocket science. It's no big deal. Just get good data, like with this soil test thing, you're going to be fine. I'm sure you're doing a great job with what you've got so far.
All right, let's take another question over here.
Ken from South Dakota.
They're giving Ken a hard time about the mic. Go ahead, Ken. Yeah, we'll get it. You're good. Oh, wait, now he turned it off on you. Why don't you make it any more challenging for him there, Ty? All right, go ahead.
I was kind of wondering what your guys' take is on growing hemp in South Dakota.
Yeah, you know, this is a big question around the country with all the states.
Industrial hemp.
That are approving. Yeah, the wild stuff grows really fine. We don't need any help with that. But the industrial stuff, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I would say this. It's a new crop, probably for 2020 if everything passes. There'll be some regulations around it, I'm sure. And right now, from what I've heard, there at this time are about three processors that are interested in contracting some acres in South Dakota to a total of somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 acres. But a lot of that's still up in the air. It's a crop that you're going to want to contract before you start trying to grow it. It's something you're going to want to do on a small amount of acres, like everything we talk about in farming. Do it on a small amount of acres. My dad always told us the difference between farmers who are successful and those who aren't is the size of their mistakes. And you may say, well, I can make money on this crop and I can't make money on anything else. Okay, I get it. That looks like there's some potential profit there, but contract it to make sure you're going to be okay, and then do it on a small acre, because here's what's going to happen. All of a sudden now you've got residue left from that crop. And how do you deal with it? It's pretty tough. It doesn't break down as well. It's got a huge root system. So there's a number of things there that are going to come up. What are the insects that infest hemp fields? What are the diseases that you might see out there? Those kinds of things. So I think it's going to be something we're going to use in rotation, but I think it could fit in really well. I really do. I think it's well suited to our environment here and our climate.
I'm no expert on industrial hemp production. By 2020, I expect to be, though. So I'll answer more of your questions a year from now. But we got
to
see.
Yeah, I think
you know,
it's something to look into. I just think it's going to be something that we're going to do on a small scale.
Yep. All right. I think we got time for one
another
more question.
Over here. Yep.
Hi, this is Brad from Wisconsin. My question's about biological pesticides, for example, like Bavaria bassiana. Is this something we should be considering? Is it effective? How should we use it, if so?
Yeah, you know, this is the thing. There isn't much appetite in our country or around the world for new pesticides. But when you say, well,
new synthetic pesticides.
Yeah, I can take something from the soil or, bacteria or something like that's already natural out there and just use more of that to fight off our diseases in a natural way. That's a lot cheaper. It's easier to get approved. And it's got a lot of potential. So, yeah, if we have something like a bacteria or a fungus that's working for us 24/7, that's fighting disease, I like that. So if we can find things that work well and then put them in an environment where they can succeed, I think it's great. You look at, like we talked about, Aveo, which is a natural nematicide. Well, that's just a bacillus species, so a bacteria species that actually fights nematodes. We can put it on our seed. It's a lot safer than the nematicide hard chemistry options that we've got. And if we can be effective with that, that's pretty cool.
But I think that was his question. Does it work? So there are many biopesticides that we have tried so far. I would just say so far, my feeling is they aren't working as well as these synthetic pesticides.
Right, but maybe that just changes our thresholds. And maybe it's, you know what, if I'm going to put this out there for help on white mold or some other disease, I just have to act a little sooner, get it out a little earlier, give it more time.
And maybe use it in combination with something else.
You know, or maybe I put it out with something to feed that bacteria or to feed that fungus so it grows faster. So I have a bigger colony to try and fight against whatever problem we have.
Yeah,
so there's going to be some more technology coming to help these things along.
So we just tell people, try it on a small scale, see if it's working for you. The future, though, looks really bright for that stuff because there are big companies pouring billions of dollars of research into the biologicals.
Well, thanks for listening to our show today. Thanks to everybody who was here in our live audience and asking questions. We really appreciate that. Join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio. Now stay tuned for Rob Sharkey and Shark Farmer Radio.